Today on the 21st, while a majority of people experience mild symptoms if they contract COVID-19 from the coronavirus, health experts say it's the elderly who are most at risk. We'll hear from several people involved with elder care. Plus, in his time as an Illinois congressman, Aaron Schock voted anti-LGBT on numerous occasions. Now he's come out as gay in a post on his Instagram account. We'll get reaction from political leaders in the LGBT community. And we'll learn about two Illinois athletes trying to qualify for the 2020 Summer Olympic Games.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up today on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moldine. Coming up later this hour, Aaron Schock, a conservative former U.S. congressman from Peoria, voted against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell and opposed same-sex marriage. He also recently came out as gay. We'll get reactions from members of the LGBT community who have been elected to political office. Later, we'll also check in with Olympic hopefuls from Illinois. But first, all this week on the 21st, we've been taking a look at how the spread of the coronavirus is affecting our state. While a majority of people experience mild symptoms if they're exposed, health experts say it's the elderly who are at most at risk of complications from the virus. So what does this mean for the 400 assisted living facilities in Illinois, and what steps can healthy people take to avoid exposing groups who are more vulnerable to the virus? We're joined now by Dr. Teresa Rowe. She's a geriatrician and infectious diseases specialist at Northwestern Medicine. Dr. Rowe, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
Doctor, how might being exposed to the coronavirus be different for someone who's over 65, say, compared to a younger person?
Yeah, so, you know, similar to, you know, most respiratory viruses, actually older adults and those with multiple medical comorbidities or conditions are at the highest risk of being affected by this new virus and at increased risk of serious illness.
And when we talk about risk, is it more the age of the person, or is it that those age groups are more likely to have some underlying health conditions?
So I think it's actually a combination of both, which is why, you know, we both, you know, say that age can be a risk factor. So if you're, you know, generally older than age 60 or 65, you're more likely, you know, to have a worse outcome. But also, even if you're younger and you have medical, comorbidities such as heart disease or lung disease.
A few weeks ago, doctors seemed to be more concerned about flu transmission than the coronavirus. Is this virus more dangerous than the flu for older populations?
Yeah, so they're both, you know, pretty serious in older populations. I think what's different about this virus is that there's so much uncertainty and so much unknown, and the fact that, you know, we just don't know a lot about it right now. So I think that that's why this, in addition to flu, are such big concerns.
What do we know about the spread of this virus? Is it more easily spread than other viruses like the flu?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Again, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about this virus. So I think there's a lot more we'll learn as things go on. But yes, it does seem to be quite contagious and probably more so than the flu.
What steps do you recommend that family members take to protect their older relatives?
Yeah, so certainly older adults that are living in the community should most likely practice what we call sort of social distancing, where they minimize their interactions with others. If possible, you know, avoid going to things like the grocery store, have, you know, a family or friends bring groceries in, and just really kind of limit those activities. So things like, you know, bingo or dancing or things that they might be doing. Otherwise, try to stay away from that for at least the next couple of weeks while we learn more information.
What about nursing homes or other places where older people live in groups or congregate? What steps do you hope that those places are taking?
Yeah, so, you know, this is certainly a population that's most vulnerable and at highest risk of being affected, I think, by the virus. There's I would definitely direct people to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, which has a very comprehensive plan that nursing homes can take to help both prevent the virus, but also how to manage a respiratory outbreak. You know, what family and friends can do is really try to minimize, again, their visits with their loved ones. I know that can be hard, but, you know, really non-urgent visits, try to minimize as much as possible. And certainly, you know, if healthcare workers are sick, that nursing homes enforce sick leaves for those healthcare workers.
That's Dr. Charissa Rowe. She's a geriatrician and infectious disease specialist at Northwestern University. Dr. Rowe, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And as Dr. Rowe mentioned, nursing homes and retirement communities in Illinois are also taking measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Many of us have parents or grandparents who are on our minds as concerns about the virus escalate. Yesterday, our producer Libby Foster went to check in with her grandmother. Here's what she was told as she pulled up.
Hi.
Help you?
Am I able to go visit my grandma?
No. Nope.
Okay. Are they?
Complete lockdown. You can't go anywhere.
Okay, complete lockdown. They're not letting anybody in?
Anybody.
Okay.
Hi, dear.
Hi. So, yeah, they're not letting me in.
At all. Do you want me? I can get in the car, drive out, meet you uptown as you go to Starbucks or something.
I'm Mary Mason. I'm 87 years old, and I live at the Moorings of Arlington Heights, which is a continuing care retirement community. We have been advised to not have visitors. Young children under 18 aren't able to come in anymore. So all of a sudden today, it's become quite stricter. I think fear is a problem, particularly for people our age. And I don't know what you do to tone that down, but whenever you hear somebody who's an expert say that it's going to hit harder at the older population, I think people our age can't help but be nervous.
That's 87-year-old Mary Mason speaking with her granddaughter, producer Libby Foster. I'd like to bring a few more voices into the conversation now. Deb Reardance is president and CEO of Clark Lindsay, a not-for-profit retirement community in Urbana. Deb, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm also joined by Tessa French, who works with Senior Services of Central Illinois. They provide case management services in the Springfield area, including transportation and meals. Tessa, welcome.
Thank you.
And Matt Hartman is also with us. He's executive director of the Illinois Healthcare Association, an advocacy organization that represents long-term care facilities in the state. Matt, glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Deb, let's start with you. What changes have you had to make at Clark Lindsay because of COVID-19?
You know, much as a woman interviewed up from Arlington Heights, we have implemented many of those same things. We've been restricting visitors and screening visitors as they come in, and preparing residents, encouraging them not to leave the facility. We have both independent living and skilled care and assisted living, and so looking at all the needs of those populations, but all of them meet the high risk that the doctor talked about in terms of being over the age of 60. We have offered assistance and for residents to shop online, and we are monitoring residents on a more regular basis regarding temperatures and such. And now we are in the process of closing down to essential visitors only. So, again, turning away visitors that aren't absolutely essential to the healthcare providing or the well-being of the resident. This includes closing down group activities, looking at our dining arrangements so that residents have the option of receiving their meals in their apartments, or if they do come to the dining room, that there is social distance may be maintained. We're also looking at freeing up rooms so that our staff will have a place to stay if they are asked to work extra shifts. And we are ready to provide daycare for staff should the schools here in Champaign-Urbana close, which they have not yet, but yeah. We are anticipating that once the cases are become confirmed. So.
Okay. Yeah. Tessa, I understand your organization has had to temporarily halt some of its programs. Could you talk about the changes that you've made?
Yeah, absolutely. The Springfield Senior Center is actually temporarily closed to the public except by appointment only. So we do still have all of our staff in. They are still doing their casework services. We have 7 total congregate locations that provide meals for seniors throughout central Illinois. All of those congregate sites are now closed, also temporarily effective immediately. We don't want seniors to go without having a meal, so individuals that did come to the congregate sites do have the option to pick up a box lunch. They do have to request a meal 24 hours in advance. All of our home-delivered meals that we provide for individuals who are not able to get out of their house to get meals, we are still delivering those meals. All of our upcoming programs and activities, all the daily activities that we do, the special programming, all of that is canceled until further notice. And our senior transport is actually only providing transportation for medical appointments at this time.
Matt, what is the Illinois Healthcare Association recommending that nursing homes and long-term care facilities do?
Sure, certainly. We are very much in line with the recommendations of the individuals from Central Illinois Senior Services and Clark Lindsay. As you all know, the risk to our resident population is probably higher than in any other group. So we're taking this very seriously, and we're putting out daily guidance to our members, both through the Illinois Healthcare and through our national affiliate at the American Healthcare Association. So isolation and separation practices, we're strongly encouraging, giving guidance on those. We've taken a strong stance on restricting visitation and screening all visitors to the facilities. So restricting to essential workers, to government employees who are there for survey purposes, and then to individuals who are coming to see their loved ones for end-of-life care. Because while we have to strike that balance, we also have to realize that there are quality of life concerns, and we need to meet those. For the rest of those individuals, though, we're encouraging visitation through FaceTime or through conference calling or through another means, through Skype. So visitor restriction is a big piece of it. We've scaled back activities, so there are no outside activities happening in buildings anymore. That's been our guidance to members. It's been widely adopted. As I said, all individuals who are in the building, we do a screening. We do a screen for presentation of symptoms. We are doing fever screenings. We're doing questioning, sign-in. Have you been traveling to the highly impacted areas across the country or across the world, and restricting folks from entering who have those?
Go ahead, Matt.
No. As well, you know, common practice during flu season we also have in place. So hand washing upon entry of the building, and things in line with that. And as well, we've set up some strict processes to allow those remote communications for residents and others.
Sure. Tessa, I imagine, you know, some of this news could be disappointing to people who use your programs. Of course, you want to keep everybody safe, but there's also, you know, the potential for some isolation and loneliness here. How do you try to balance that with the services you offer?
Well, a lot of the services we offer do help combat social isolation, so that is a concern for us. At this time, with the risks of the coronavirus, we feel that it's important to keep our seniors' health and safety in mind, and then we'll be able to get back to really working on the social isolation side. But it's not going to be very effective for us to work on that if we're making our seniors, if they're getting sick from being in these group settings.
Right. And Deb, you know, what have you been hearing from residents and family members about these changes?
I will say the overall reaction has been very positive, and they're grateful that we are staying ahead of the curve on this. And I would echo what Tessa said about worrying about the social isolation. No one knows how long these measures will have to be in place. And everyone's attitude about doing what they can to help keep the community safe is very positive. But over time, that will be difficult to maintain, and I worry about that. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Sure. And Deb, I'm just curious if you can kind of just walk us through your decision-making process on these things. Have you been, you know, following CDC guidelines? Are you getting recommendations from state and other national agencies? What information are you using here?
Yeah, so it is information overload, but we are staying true to reconciling the recommendations from CDC, from Illinois Department of Public Health, and from the local Champaign-Urbana public health agency. So sometimes there are minor contradictions, and in the cases where we can take the safest route, we are. But we're also part of Leading Age Illinois, which is a network of not-for-profit nursing homes across the state. And so there's a lot of reaching out to members and peers who are in the hot spots of the state and are maybe having to move into action even faster. And so there's a lot of sharing, and that has been extremely helpful and supportive.
Matt, just about a minute left here, but I'm curious, have you learned anything from this outbreak? Are the facilities in Illinois that you advocate for, are they generally prepared, or have you learned about some gaps maybe?
I think for the most part they're prepared. We deal with the flu season every year, and we take similar precautions. Obviously, with the high mortality rate of coronavirus and with how it spread in Seattle, we have to be extra diligent, and I find that we are. The place where we have some concern is with the availability of personal protection equipment, so that's something we're monitoring closely. Our members know to reach out to us, to the Department of Public Health, but I think that the plans that we have in place, our emergency preparedness and our infection prevention plans are working to date, because we have yet to see a case in a center. And because of the virulent nature of the virus, I suspect it may eventually make its way in, but we feel strong where we are right now.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut you off right there, Matt, unfortunately. Matt Hartman, Executive Director of the Illinois Healthcare Association, Tessa French with Senior Social Services of Central Illinois, and Deb Reardance with Clark Lindsay. Thank you all for joining us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline. Last week, Aaron Schock, the former GOP representative from Central Illinois, came out as gay in an Instagram post. After entering Congress in 2009 as the youngest member of the legislative body, Schock resigned in 2015 amidst a scandal surrounding his spending and use of public funds. He was later arraigned on federal fraud charges and pleaded not guilty to 24 counts of felony corruption. Those charges were later dropped by prosecutors. Since this post last week, many members of the LGBT community have struggled to reconcile the news with Schock's track record on LGBT issues. In his time as a lawmaker, Schock opposed same-sex marriage and the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He also voted against hate crime protections for members of the LGBT community and voted for the Defense of Marriage Act. In his Instagram post, Schock writes in part, quote, "I realize that some of my political positions run very much counter to the mainstream of the LGBTQ movement, and I respect them for these differences. I hope that others can respect that for me being gay has not required stepping into some entirely new belief system." For more on this, we're joined on the line by Anise Parker. She's president of the LGBTQ Victory Fund. She's also the former mayor of Houston, Texas. Welcome to the 21st, Anise.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And we're also joined on the line by Kevin Morrison. He's a Cook County Board Commissioner of the 15th District. Commissioner Morrison, thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Anise, let's start with you here. Let's go back to the political landscape about a decade ago. What was it like for openly LGBT candidates when Aaron Schock arrived in Washington, and were there many?
Well, there were several hundred out LGBT elected officials across the United States, and many of us at that point had been in office for years. We've been electing out LGBT elected officials since the 1970s. Was it more difficult 10 years ago? Yes. Were there other examples of folks who had more courage 10 years ago? Yes.
Kevin, I'm curious for you, Schock coming out this year, you know, a time when another openly gay man, Pete Buttigieg, claimed the victory in the Iowa caucuses. Do you think that this could be part of the reason that he chose right now to do it?
You know, I can't answer to his progression. And, you know, coming out of the closet, first and foremost, is a difficult decision for anyone and any member of the community. It sounds like he had a difficult family surrounding and a very conservative upbringing. And, you know, I can't answer as to what led him to come out now, but, you know, on his journey, that this was his path. Now was the time he decided to come out.
Anise, I'm curious how the political landscape might have changed for LGBT candidates, you know, within the last 5 or 10 years or so. Are there any numbers that you can tell us about in regards to that?
Certainly, 2018 was a watershed year for out candidates. There were more than 700 who ran all across the country that year. We've already identified more than 700 openly LGBT candidates just through the end of February this year. So the numbers keep increasing. And the numbers of openly LGBT elected officials holding office has grown. We're approximately 850 right now. Victory Institute, which I run, operates something called the, or manages something called the Out for America map, and it shows every current LGBT elected official. But we have two U.S. governors, we have two United States senators, we have multiple members of Congress, and then, of course, a number of big city mayors. It's not that the world changed 5 years ago. It's more that candidates started stepping up in greater numbers. And where we run openly and honestly, we get elected on our own merits. The Pete Buttigieg effect is, we see some of that this year. I think his success is inspiring candidates. But the rainbow wave of candidates had already started in 2018 and has continued apace. But Pete's success is going to inspire even more people out into inner politics going forward.
I'd kind of like to get the reaction just from both of you. Your initial reaction when you read Aaron Schock's coming out statements. Kevin, let's start with you.
To be honest, when I initially read his statement, I felt a great amount of pity. You know, I myself had, you know, a difficult coming out story with my own father, and I received some pushback from some people within my family. But I felt that this decision obviously was incredibly difficult, most likely for the former congressman, and I felt pity. I felt that he obviously was showing a amount of regret. There was obviously a lot of anger within the community because he did not come out and say, I apologize for my former record. But I think this opens up the door for hopefully some redemption. And I hope he uses the voice that he has to do whatever he can to benefit the community moving forward. I honestly think that someone with his record, you know, if he uses his voice now to help individuals who are in public office and still in the closet on their path to coming out, I think that would actually be a great way for him to redeem some of the issues the community has with his voting record.
Anise, how about you?
I agree with Kevin that this is an opportunity for him to redeem himself, but he has to want to. You know, part of what Victory does is that we routinely work with closeted elected officials who've decided to come out. But generally, part of that coming out process involves an apology for a past. Not every closeted LGBT official has an anti-gay voting record, and I will point out that Representative Schock had a zero rating from HRC, but you know, some of them have actually good ally records. They're just personally closeted, but when someone who has publicly and overtly taking positions against the LGBT community, and they want to resurrect their political career, it involves an act of contrition. And he's shown no interest in that. So while we wish him well going forward, and it begs the question of whether this time in office he was a deeply troubled man trying to hide his shame, or whether he was a hypocrite deliberately manipulating voters' opinions. If he fully believes that he was justified in all of his positions, I think he's going to have a hard time integrating into the broader LGBT community. Being LGBT does not imply a political position, and victory is bipartisan, but it does imply that you don't vote for things that hurt fellow members of the community. And I think until and unless he decides that perhaps some of his political positions need to change, he's going to have some hard times.
Commissioner Morrison, you yourself are openly LGBT, and you're also the youngest Cook County commissioner to serve. I wonder if a part of you feels like the difficulties that people like Aaron Schock have faced helped pave the way for candidates like yourself.
Well, I would say that through my upbringing and my journey was a lot different than Aaron Schock's journey. I was fortunate to go to a university that had a very robust LGBTQ community on my campus when I went to DePaul University. It was really through seeing figures like Barack Obama reach the presidency, marriage equality. It was seeing the progression of LGBTQ rights and, more importantly, leaders in the community and our allies supporting the progression of our rights that not only inspired me to come out of the closet in the first place, but ultimately to feel comfortable running as openly LGBT in a historically Republican district. You know, I flipped my district for the first time. It was the first time that it flipped Democratic in its history. And I did that based on the needs and the issues of my community and fighting for better access to healthcare, mental health care services, the issues that are really the focus of the northwest suburbs of Cook County. And I would say it was leaders of our community, of the LGBTQ community, and our allies that inspired me to where I am today. And I'm thankful for people like Mayor Anise Parker and her voice that led to people like me being able to run as openly LGBTQ.
Anise, I think we have a narrative that rural America is more conservative, faith-based, maybe even homophobic. But is that reflected in how people actually vote or the candidates that they support?
We win wherever we run, as long as we're the best candidate for that district and on the issues that voters care about. There's an openly gay member of the Alabama House of Representatives. There's an openly gay member of the Arkansas House of Representatives. There are five women representing the community in Texas, five in Georgia, three in Florida. We can get elected anywhere. The number of our out LGBT officials flipped seats in 2018. From Republican to Democratic, so they clearly position themselves as bridge builders and appealed to more conservative voters. And there are definitely people who vote against our candidates because of their sexual orientation or gender identity, but the number shrinks every year, and they are, I would suspect, not going to vote for a candidate for a lot of other reasons as well. Interestingly, the number of in some places there's almost a reverse effect, is that candidates who are comfortable in their own skin, they're openly LGBTQ, they reveal that to voters, and voters respect their honesty and their integrity and reward them for it.
You know, Kevin, I'm also curious about maybe any sort of reconciliation or reckoning that Schock might have to contend with when it comes to his anti-LGBT voting record. You know, what did he say in his statements and what reactions have you heard from the broader community about his coming out?
Well, first and foremost, I think it was an important statement in itself that he has finally found a place where he is comfortable saying that he is gay and coming out in the first place. There were many individuals who questioned when that moment might come, but there is still a lot of anger in the community. Now, me personally, I recognize there's very little you can do about the past, but there's so much opportunity about what you can do in the future. And so I recognize that there are a lot of individuals who were hurt by the policies that Aaron Schock supported when he was in Congress. But this is an opportunity now that he is out of the closet to really focus on that reconciliation and redemption. And honestly, I have come in contact with a lot of in the closet individuals who are in public service roles. And I feel like there is a greater need not only to help individuals coming out of the closet. This is one of the reasons why I work with organizations like Victory Fund, helping elect LGBTQ leaders across the nation. But also, I feel like it's important for there to be a voice like Aaron Schock's in the conservative community talking about, for one, those God values of God is the only judge. There's so much hatred that and fear that comes from certain sections of the Christian community against LGBTQ individuals. And there is a need for voices to really change that narrative and make it so there is a broad acceptance of LGBTQ people in more rural locations. We know that marriage equality is the support of which is over 50% across the board, across the country. There is great support for our community, and we just need to make sure that there are voices that are bridging those supporters in those communities so that they are confident to help speak to their neighbors about LGBTQ issues. I think there is a great opportunity for voices like Aaron to hopefully push and support our community moving forward. And I really hope he does so if he really wants to be a vocal and integrated member of the LGBTQ community.
Just a minute or two left here, but ultimately, Anise, whether Schock supports LGBT causes moving forward, we certainly know that as you've alluded to, LGBT political figures, just like heterosexual candidates, have a wide variety of political views. Is that something you think people fully realize?
I don't know that people completely realize that. We do regularly fight the assumption that if you're openly LGBT, you have to be aligned on the far left. With those of us who are elected in conservative places, as I was in Texas, we tend to be centrist. Pete Buttigieg got some of that from within the LGBT community, that he had to be orthodox on certain far left questions, which he was not, and received criticism. But I do agree with Commissioner Morrison that Adam Schock has an opportunity, but he has to want to take advantage of that opportunity. He had the benefits of the closet when it was convenient for him while he was in office. He wants the benefits of acceptance within the community now that he's no longer in office. I think he is going to have to do some things to earn that acceptance, and there was nothing in his coming out statement that indicated his interest in doing that. And there's obviously nothing in the statement. He, in fact, repudiated any suggestion that his positions had been any way wrong. And I think there are going to be a lot of folks who have ongoing concern about that.
Anise Parker is the president of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and former mayor of Houston, Texas. Kevin Morrison, Cook County Board Commissioner for the 15th District. Thanks both of you for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the 21st. I'm Brian Moldine. The Summer Olympic Games are scheduled to be held in Tokyo, Japan later this year. Athletes from across the country are attempting to qualify for the U.S. Olympic team, including many from Illinois. We'll learn about two of those athletes today. First, we'll talk to Tyler Pence. He's the head coach of the track and cross-country programs at the University of Illinois Springfield, and he recently competed at the Olympic trials for the men's marathon team in Atlanta. Tyler, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're actually talking to you from Alabama today. What's happening down there?
So I'm here in Alabama. We have Division II Indoor Track and Field Nationals, and my freshman, Karen Christie, she's going to be running the 5K on Friday, so we actually drove down here yesterday.
Great. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Olympic trials. How did you qualify to compete there?
Yeah, I ran Tower National Marathon back in December of 2018. That was my first real marathon that I trained for, and, you know, I kind of thought maybe the Olympic trial standard was a possibility, and I had known the past history of Cal International was a very competitive race and was a good opportunity for me to hopefully get a mark, and I ended up going there, and that's where I ended up hitting the qualifying mark for me to get to the trials.
What was that qualifying time?
2:15:36.
Wow. I'm just as someone who's run half marathons in close to that time, that just is amazing to me.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the race where you qualified. You said it was Power National. Where is that race?
It's California International. It's in Sacramento, California. And, you know, they have every year, statistically, if you look at the trials and where people qualified from, I'd say a majority are from Cal International. It's a fast course, and they get great competition out there where, you know, I think it's the first time I've ever ran with so many people who are going for an Olympic standard. And it was just really cool. You had a big group of people pulling you along and just a good opportunity to hit an Olympic mark for sure.
Yeah. And how did things go for you down in Atlanta?
They went okay. You know, I went in there with high expectations. You know, I was in the best shape of my life, and you know, it's one of the situations where I was going for top three or I was going for broke. And, you know, I threw myself in the mix. I was in the top group for about 20 miles of the race. And then late in the race, I ran some cramping problems and ended up having to step off, which is unfortunate. Obviously not the result you want, but at the end of the day, I went there. I knew I was going to kind of risk it and go for it. And sometimes that's the price to pay.
From everything I've read, it sounds like the Olympic Trials marathon course in Atlanta was a tough one. Would you agree with that assessment?
It was, absolutely. It was extremely challenging. However, we all knew that going in that it was going to be a tough race. It was going to be a grinder. And, you know, we also had about a 20-mile-an-hour wind that day as well. So, you know, we knew it was going to be tough, and that's just part of it.
What made that course so difficult?
Just the elevation change. You know, if you look at the course and the elevation, there's never a flat spot. So you're either going up or you're going down. And, you know, a lot of people, you hear downhill and you think that sounds nice. Well, it's really not. And it actually beats up your body just as much as it does going uphill. So, you know, there's a lot of 180-degree turns as well, and that kind of throws you off. So a lot of people who go there, and if you're a rhythm runner, which a lot of people are who do marathons, you know, this was a course that was going to make you hurt, and it was going to challenge you. So, you know, just the ups and the downs and the tight turns, it definitely made it challenging, for sure.
How long had it been a goal of yours to make it to the Olympic trials?
You know, I've been asked that a lot, and it hasn't been that long. I've always been somebody who was kind of had goals in the moment and nothing too long term. You know, so when I was in high school, I just wanted to be on top seven, or I wanted to make the state meet. I never thought past high school, and then when I got to college, I wanted to get national titles and be on All-American. And then I graduated, and I started to coach, and I did one half marathon just for fun, and I was within a minute of hitting the Olympic trial standard. And I was like, shoot, I need to, if I really buckle down and go for the standard. I think I can get it. And, you know, I'm surrounded by my athletes every day, and it just really motivated me to, you know, go chase something, be somebody that can inspire them. And I really, you know, found my love for the sport again post-collegiately, and that's where I decided I'm gonna really set the goal of qualifying and do it.
And I want to touch on something I thought I heard you say earlier, but how many marathons have you run in your career?
Two now. I ran Calgary National to qualify, and I ran the Olympic Trials. Wow. So, yeah, I'm very young in my marathon career. I think over the next 4 years, though, before the next Olympic Trials, that's where I'll start to hopefully gain a lot more experience in the marathon, because that's one thing that I think a lot of people have the advantage on me right now. Is I just haven't done many of them.
Any particular races that you're really wanting to really get under your belt now? Any particular places you want to run?
Yeah, I want to do the majors. I want to do Chicago. I want to do Boston, New York. You know, those are very competitive, and I think those are the ones that are going to give me the best idea of what it's like racing the elite groups and preparing me for the next Olympic trials. So I definitely want to go run those majors. So for sure.
Did you find it difficult to train for the trials while also being a full-time coach, or did it help you in some way?
No, because my lifestyle is surrounded by running. So, you know, when we wake up for practice, there's a lot of days I can go run with them. However, if we're doing a workout, you know, I take care of the workout, and then throughout my day, you know, I can go step out of my office at any time in the day and go run. And I think that's one thing where if I had a different 9-to-5 job, I wouldn't have that luxury. And that's why I think coaching, it's a great opportunity for one, do coaching, which I love to do and I'm extremely passionate about, but I can also chase the dream of these high goals I have in my own individual running. So, you know, you definitely make it work. There are times where when I'm traveling on the weekends to meets and whatnot, it becomes challenging to train, but, you know, I make it work, and it's definitely easier than most jobs would be to continue training for sure.
How have your athletes responded, first to you qualifying and then to how things went in Atlanta?
Super well. You know, we're one big team, and I think that's one thing I talk to a lot of people about. You know, I'm technically not on a pro team, but I am a part of a team, and that's UIS Cross Country. They were extremely supportive of my training. You know, they see me put in the work. I run from our athletic center on campus, and they see when I do my workouts and everything. So it's cool that they're part of that journey, just like I'm a part of theirs. And, you know, we just both support each other on both ends. Obviously, when the race didn't go as planned, they know what that's like. They've had races not go how they wanted. And, you know, they were just as supportive as I would be towards them if they weren't to have the best race of their career or anything like that. So it's just really cool to really be a part of the team and kind of feed off each other. I think while I help them a lot, that's my job, they also help motivate me in return, and it's really cool for sure.
And Tyler, what's your next big running goal?
You know, my next big running goal is to make the team in 2024. You know, I left the Olympic Trials this year kind of with a chip on my shoulder, and I'd like to spend the next 4 years really preparing and come back with kind of that chip on my shoulder and do something big for sure.
Tyler Pence is the head track and cross-country coach at the University of Illinois Springfield. He recently competed at the Olympic Trials for the men's marathon. Tyler, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Another Olympic hopeful from Illinois is Dawn Harper-Nelson. She was the Olympic champion in the 100-meter hurdles in 2008 and won the silver medal in the same event at the 2012 Olympics. The East St. Louis native retired in 2018 to have her first child, but is back in training ahead of the Olympic trials in June. Joining us on the phone now is Andrea Henderson. She's a reporter with the public radio collaborative Sharing America, covering the intersection of race, identity, and culture. And she recently did a feature story on Dawn Harper-Nelson for St. Louis Public Radio. Andrea, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Andrea, one of the biggest parts of your story on Dawn Harper-Nelson is some of the challenges that she's faced trying to find sponsorships after coming out of retirement. First, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why those sponsorships are so important for high-level track athletes.
Yeah, she really just went in and talked about everything, things that you probably wouldn't even think about. Like for her, she says that, you know, she needs sponsorships for vitamins that she has to pay for, that are essentially that she's paying for out of pocket right now, shoes, apparel, even little things like massages. So just anything that you can think of that an athlete may need, or training equipment and things like that, then that is what she's looking for in regards to sponsorships. And what she's saying is why she needs those, that amount of money to kind of just keep pushing her, so she won't have to think about finding a sponsor, trying to compete, or at least trying to make it to this Olympic trials, you know. And she's really just trying to use this, her leverage here in the greater St. Louis area to find those sponsorships because of her being at home now. She's really looking for something that is going to help propel her to that next level like she once had before.
And why has Dawn had so much trouble getting a sponsorship?
She said it wasn't because once she retired in 2018, she was released from her contract, which was before she was pregnant. So we didn't want to confuse the listeners that it was because she was pregnant, like she stated in the interview. But it was also, it was because she actually retired, and it was just her contract was up. But when she came back, she said they're kind of just like, oh, we know what your potential is. We've seen you run, you know, your races. But now that you've had a baby, let's see where you are, kind of prove yourself again. So she didn't really want to say that it was all because she had a baby, but it was kind of alluding to the fact that, you know, like we've seen across the, you know, the United States, across the globe, women are having, no matter their race, they're having struggles with making sure that they are securing these sponsorships. Women athletes are having, you know, a little bit more trouble trying to secure these sponsorships because they either have become pregnant or they are mothers or things like that. So she kind of just wanted to make sure people knew that she didn't get dropped because she was pregnant, but now that she has a baby, they're kind of telling her she needs to prove herself again to them.
Mm. You know, you talked with Dawn after one of her workouts at Belleville West High School recently. How does she think her training's going so far?
You know, it was brutally cold that day. So I applaud her just being a person, watching her, just sitting there, being with her. I was trying to contain myself. I kept thinking, like, how are you doing this? And it's extremely cold. It's extremely windy out here. And she was really good. She was confident. She looked good. Her body looked great. Her coaching staff, which is her husband, he even told her, you know, she had a couple of moments where she didn't feel like she was doing well, even though she hit her numbers every time. But she just kind of was getting a little hard on herself. But she looked really great. And from what I can tell, you know, she's going to be ready come the Olympic trials.
Yeah, we talked about sponsorship, but what are some of the other challenges that Dawn is facing as she tries to come back?
She said it's really just like physically, she's physically fit, you know, but just making sure that her body is top notch. Like she knows what her body felt like before she had a baby. And now she, her child is 11 months, I believe. Now 11 months later, you know, there are differences in a woman's body, but if you continue to work out and you continue to stay in shape and you're an athlete, you're able to bounce back just a little bit quicker than the average woman who is not an athlete. But she says she's really critical on herself physically and just mentally being in the space to where she can focus solely on just running. She's kind of balancing, you know, now being a new mother, but now that she has the support from her family and her friends, like even though she had that before, but she's home now. So she says she has a great amount of support here so that she can, when she hit that track, she can make sure that she's really focused on doing what she has to do to come home to St. Louis with that gold medal in her hand. So I would say some physical, I wouldn't say that the physical is a detriment to what she's kind of working on now, but she's hard on herself physically. And she says just thinking about her child sometimes, like I'm missing some moments, you know, maybe she's with a nanny or with her friend or with a family member, but sometimes she wants to be there with her, but she knows she has another goal of getting this medal come the summer games.
Andrea Henderson is a reporter with Sharing America, who recently profiled Dawn Harper Nelson for St. Louis Public Radio as she gets ready for the Olympic trials coming up in June. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the show with analysis and background about what we're discussing. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering come from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.